Welcome back to Tiger Talk, everyone. This is Carney Ann Nasser. It's hard to believe that Tiger Talk started over a year ago now. And in that year, we have seen so many dramatic changes. Of course, we saw the train wreck of a reality show, Tiger King, which fortunately did have a silver lining insofar as it brought attention to the issue of America's tiger crisis, backyard tigers, private ownership of tigers, and the roadside zoos that are breeding and dumping them. So we've had a number of extraordinary guests on this podcast, and today we are going to welcome back Alex Tello from Tellus Films and his brother Sam Tello, so they can tell us more about what they've been up to in this last year. They are the ones who are bringing stories to life of the rescues that our reputable sanctuaries, our heroic sanctuary founders, are instrumental in bringing about. They are the ones who are cleaning up the messes that people like Joe Exotic and Jeff Lowe, who just had all of his big cats confiscated by the federal government. Thankfully, those cats are all headed to reputable and accredited sanctuaries. We've seen every single roadside zoo owner who was featured in Tiger King, except for one, now in prison, under investigation, indicted for wildlife trafficking or animal cruelty. And we are all in this battle alongside with our friend Carol Baskin to ensure that the Big Cat Public Safety Act gets passed. So let's talk with Alex and Sam. Let's hear what they've been up to and see where we're at. See what's happened in the last year, the good, the bad, and everything in between. So let's get into some Tiger Talk.
Lately, we've been trying to just focus on the good sanctuaries that are doing good so that we can highlight them and document some of the good stuff that they're doing. But we have seen some of those sanctuaries or roadside zoos that you're talking about. And it's unfortunate that they're still going on. And it's not even roadside zoos anymore. It's your accredited zoos that are doing the bad stuff now too as well. So it's kind of unfortunate, but I mean, we've been all around, all the way up to, the East Coast to the West Coast. I think the last one that we did was in Florida. Mm-hmm. And that one was about capuchin monkeys. So a guy owned a couple capuchin monkeys and decided after 27 years, he's going to surrender them to a sanctuary.
We talked about this last year, right?
We did. So, which is good, because this is something that I would like to eventually use this as a, to help maybe help pass like the Primate Public Safety Act.
Absolutely.
Because I'm sure that's probably going to be the next thing to follow after the Big Cat Public Safety Act. And I know.
I think that people have some familiarity with the Big Cat Public Safety Act at this point, banning the private ownership of big cats and prohibiting exhibitors from offering the public contact that incentivizes this puppy mill style breeding of big cats that end up supplying the private owners.
Right.
But what would the Primate Public Safety Act accomplish?
I think it's pretty much for the same. I think it would stop people breeding them, especially. Well, so what happens is when they breed, it's almost the same thing with the tiger. They breed them and they take them out. They take them from their mother, it's too soon before they're able to actually be on their own. And we show that in one of our episodes. So I think what it will stop, it was to have people owning them privately in homes as well, and then the need of having to use them in entertainment. Still seeing it till today. It's 2021. I just read an article, I believe in The Guardian, the Offspring, the punk band just used chimpanzees for their music video, which is unfortunate because I really love that band. It was like I grew up with them. I love that punk music.
I went to see them in concert when I was in college in San Diego. I went to an Offspring concert Easter.
Yes, Sam and I saw them multiple times. I mean, we would drive out to Bakersfield at one point just to go see them. You know, but it's unfortunate, like these guys, they've been around for a while. They haven't been, you know, doing anything lately, but then they come out with this. It's just like, it's so unfortunate. I'm like, where have you guys been living? You know, if you not noticed that a lot of the Hollywood films now are not even using animals anymore, real animals. Right. It's turned into CG. And I think that's part of what the Primate Public Safety Act will do, is that we need to stop using them in entertainment purposes. These little using them as in rodeos, as you know, rodeo clowns, which is it's horrible. Other than the fact that rodeos are, you know, such a barbarian sport as well to begin with, that needs to go away. So I think all of this would teach us that you know, start opening our eyes that these animals are not here for our entertainment purposes. We need to protect them. We need to speak out for them, and that's why Sam and I are here for. You know, that's why you're here for as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I'm curious because you mentioned CGI and, you know, for the two of you as filmmakers, I mean, does that something that's exciting to you to see that? Because that seems like that is a creative endeavor that can add to the industry in a really cool way, rather than like such a like archaic throwback to like dressing up animals in costumes. Like, so what are your thoughts on that? And what do you think the broader industry feeling that you've noticed is about this evolution into CGI?
I think the companies are definitely looking into, if there's animals involved in the film, they're probably thinking about it twice now if they're actually using an animal, because of all the backlash that people can, you know, that they'll get, especially now with animal rights activists being a little bit more aware because of social media and stuff like that. So I think they're doing more of an effort now to start using CG. I know it probably costs a million times more money, but it's more ethical and it's the right thing to do. I mean, you can do so much with this CGI. I mean, look at all the Planet of the Apes movies. Amazing.
Yeah, film. So impressive.
Amazing. If they would have probably used real chimps, I probably would have not watched the film. People need to learn to like that when these animals are being used for entertainment, it's abuse. It's not, it's not that, you know, that these animals are having fun. It's it's torture for them.
And when I tell people is like, you know, especially when you're talking about exotic animals, the abuse happens before they ever get to the set. You know, it happens in training. It happens behind the scenes. We saw that with Ty, the elephant who was used in Water for Elephants. Video surfaced after the fact of her being electric shocked, being, you know, viciously beaten during training. So it's the greatest concern is during training, when there are no monitoring eyes on them, there are no people monitoring training. So it's definitely a concern. Sam, what are your thoughts about like this evolution into CGI?
I think it's fantastic. Alex and I, you know, obviously we're, you know, animals have always been a big, you know, big deal with us growing up. And so, you know, as filmmakers, you know, and branching out to do narrative and, you know, we would have always anticipated possibly using animals as characters in future films. But the dilemma of using an animal as a real, you know, actor in a film, you know, that's where we're at that crossroads where, well, we don't have to think about it anymore because now CGI has bridged that gap. It looks fantastic. For the biggest, you know, sticklers, maybe there's a little thing that you can say, okay, it doesn't look 100% real, but it's so close. It's absolutely so close. There's really, you know, if it's a budget reasons, you know, I can't imagine, you know, morally, you just got to go with CGI.
Well, and I would imagine that like everything over time, there is going to be, it's not going to be as cost prohibitive. Like with everything, as the technology becomes more broadly, it would be as more people become proficient in it and as technology evolves and I would imagine that cost would eventually like come down.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. I mean, it's the main reason why it's being used more and more You know, in every film, you know, you see films where, you know, they're introducing CGI when you can build, you can, in your mind, you're thinking, well, you didn't have to shoot that in CGI. You could have just gone outside and shot that, you know, scene, but they're doing that because sometimes it's just more cost effective that way than, you know.
Oh, that's a great point. That's awesome.
You know, so it's happening. It's happening.
Yeah. There's really no excuses. Right. So did you guys, I'm curious, did you guys, like, what came first? Your interest in filmmaking and pursuing that as a career, or your interest in speaking up for animals? Like, how did you evolve to get to the point where you were utilizing your creative talents to create documentary films and raise awareness about the exploitation of exotic animals and tell their stories?
Well, I think it might have, maybe it might have started with me probably just, I worked in post-production starting, you know, probably like around 2000 was when I graduated audio video post-production school. So I started learning all of that. And at the same time, while I was at work, I was also very fascinated with some of the stuff that was going on in the animal world. I was always an animal lover. But spending so much time in the room watching movies all day and working in post, and then, you know, going on the news and seeing all this stuff that was going on. I think it was around the mad cow disease time that I started reading more and more about the farming, the factory farming, and started opening my eyes. I started, stopped eating meat, and I started realizing more of the animal rights issues that are going on. I was really more into, you know, just narrative film. Sam and I were doing little short dark comedies was kind of our thing. Writing that sort of things, going out with, you know, friends, filming, you know, mostly all narratives. Never really thought about the whole documentary world. And then one day I actually ended up wanting to sign up to the Sea Shepherd.
Wow.
I wanted to go out and I have my post-production skills and my camera skills. I want to go out and see, maybe I can do, you know, do my part and help. You know, of course, when you have to do that, it takes about, you know, you're out there for about a year. So it's not like, you know, a month or two. So my wife was like, well, why don't you start something here locally and see if we can, you know, move on up. So she actually introduced me to the Sanctuary, which is the wildlife way station here in California. It was a sanctuary that was shut down. She's like, you can go out there and volunteer if you like. I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? Let me go. So I went and I saw that there was all these exotic animals literally in my backyard. I mean, just 20 mm-hmm. minutes away from where I was living, you know, tigers, bears, all these animals. And then they start talking to me and telling me about that. Well, these come from circuses. These come from, this come from an illegal drug dealer. This comes from blah, 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 this and so forth. And I started opening my eyes and I was like, wow. I was like, I didn't even know this was even going on. So I left that day thinking to myself, okay, so there's a little bit more that I could do than just come here and just help volunteer as far as, you know, picking up poop for the day and sweeping up here and there. It's like, I don't know how much help I'm doing. Yeah, I'm sure I'm probably helping the sanctuary a lot. But in the long run, I don't know how much I'm actually doing. So I decided, you know what? Let me put all of my savings, all my money into it. I'm going to make a documentary so that we can tell the world that sanctuaries out there exist. This is what's going on. And the reason why they exist is because of all these animals that are being traded, that are being traded, you know, and this includes zoos as well. Not just private ownerships. So I went into the deep hole of the internet and started just digging more and more and more. And I started talking to Sam more. And then, you know, Sam's been very supportive on the cause and jumped in. And we one day just grabbed all my money and savings. And we're like, all right, let's go for a month. Let's just go for a month. Let's take, at the time, Sam's fiance, I guess, a girlfriend. I don't know if they were, I guess they weren't married yet. This was a little over 10 years ago. Now they're married, have two beautiful kids. But it was most of us were not necessarily professionals. I mean, I did work in post-production. I never had actually shot a full feature documentary or anything like that. So, you know, like, let's just go. Let's just contact these sanctuaries. Let's find out what's going on in the world. So we went pretty much from California. I think it led us all the way to Florida. We just went out for a month.
Arizona, Oklahoma.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So we just went out, we're just contacting sanctuary by sanctuary, and and filming, documenting their story.
Yeah.
And sure enough, we started, I mean, it just started trickling into more and more and more stuff. And then we figured, you know what, this is, it's a never ending story. We need to continue with it. They have so many stories to tell every single day. And there's so many calls that they're having for, you know, having to rescue certain animals and different species. And especially right now, the hot thing is tigers, because we have so many of them here in the US.
Yeah. And
that's a constant phone call that they're getting. We need a tiger to be rescued. I mean, you know, I don't need to tell you, you're the tiger expert, but you know, that's, and that's kind of how it's, it kind of started. So we decided, at least for me, I decided to focus more on dedicating my life to kind of document more of the animal rights issues, and kind of stepped away from the whole narrative, as much as I still would like to do some narrative, but it just, the whole animal,
there's a reason.
There's a
to continue.
It felt it felt like it, I had to, like we have to. It's a necessity. It's, you know.
I mean, to me, this issue kind of found me as well, because you know, I'd wanted to work in animal advocacy. I was sure of that, but I wasn't really sure where I would be best suited. And I remember my first animal law job that I applied for was focused on promoting plant-based diets and alternatives to animal testing. And I remember I was so sad that I didn't get that job. I remember I was pregnant and emotional, and I was sitting in the parking lot of my doctor's office, just sobbing because I'd gotten this rejection call. And thank goodness, because like, I mean, I would have completely missed this whole, and if I hadn't found that path as good of a match, who knows if I would have even stayed in animal protection work, if I maybe would have thought, oh, this maybe isn't the right fit at all for me. So yeah, it's interesting how the issue has found all of us. Sam, is that like pretty much, did Alex give a
That's essentially it, honestly. You know, the whole, like, I remember actually the moment where it was more like we're doing it was we were sitting in a cafe in Santa Cruz. We had just did we win an award or something? I don't know. We were there in some Santa Cruz Film Festival for the dark comedy that we shot, and so we were there having, you know, a coffee, or you know, it was late. And so, you know, Alex is just, you know, this could be our next project, not knowing that this is our next project for the next 10, 11 years, it just kind of, you know, it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I think the film itself is kind of indicative of what our experience was filming it, because you know, even the conversations, the way in which it's shot and everything is essentially just kind of revealing it as we're experiencing it as well, because we're not, you know, we're not experts. We're not trying to, you know, show you snippets or specific moments. We're actually just kind of like, okay, this is what we got, because this is all we know. This is what we can ask, because this is all we know to ask. You know, so we came in fresh, and I think we did a good job. I think we kind of painted a picture of what we, as a outsider coming in, you know, for the first time, learning what a sanctuary was. And so, you know, from that point on, you know, we kind of wanted to evolve it into, well, you know, we can show people what's going on day to day, but I think it'd be nice to show, you know, why it's being done, you know, and what the why is, and the animals that need the rescue. And so we decided to go towards in that route with the series and say, let's focus on these rescues, specifically these moments that you know, can paint that picture of, like, you know, it's a teachable moment for people. I think, you know, a lot of the, like, the stories that we're learning and we're finding out are they're not like these extravagant, crazy, weird, messed up stories necessarily, not all of them at least, but a lot of them are just, you know, people who had, you know, like Alex mentioned, the monkeys, he had them for 27 years, no one would have known, you know, he had them in he had pets, they're part of his family for so long, and then, you know, life happened, and now he says, well, I can't have them anymore. But, you know, it's, it's the animals that are going to have to go, not him, right? So you know, that's our that was our job there, was to show that, you know, it can happen to everyone. And in a situation like that, it's a poor, you know, it's an animal that's not going to have a life anywhere other than in a sanctuary or in the home that they grew up in. So either they're there or they're not. And, you know, we hope that they are somewhere, you know, as opposed to being euthanized like so many other animals do.
Right. Yeah, so, that's true. So I yesterday I was talking to my husband, and he was had such a cynical viewpoint. He was like, oh, you know, you're never going to end the problem entirely. Like, you know, these exotic animal pets, like tigers is, even we were just talking about tigers, you're never going to end the problem. And I'm like the forever optimist. I'm like,
right.
If you make it illegal to have public contact, you are removing this cash cow for the roadside zoos and the unscrupulous breeder dealers. And then these animals become just these giant, dangerous financial liabilities. Yeah. And you're drying up the supply that feeds the exotic pet market for these animals that ultimately end up in people's homes. So yes, I'm like, I do believe we can bring this, like, I believe that we can curtail this problem. Are you guys with me or?
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I mean, a perfect example is like it shows like in the Tiger King, what was he doing? He was getting rid of tigers so he can bring in more so that he can make more money off of the photo op pet. Petting the tigers. So like you said, you make it illegal, he can't go out and purchase more. So he's stuck with those, you know, they're stuck with those tigers until they die. You know, they don't necessarily have to kill 20 tigers to bring in another 20 cubs.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, yes, I think you make it illegal. I think it's going to make it harder for this to continue on. And we started, you know, we started here in the US and let it start trickling down to the rest of the world because it's a problem. It's a big, huge problem in the rest of the world. You know, and I'm still hearing people going to different resorts and stuff and paying to do this. And
dolphins. We haven't
touched
on that, of course. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's super popular other parts of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think you make it illegal, I think it's going to make it harder. I'm not saying it's going to go away completely, but we'll probably
significantly. I mean, I think we get to a day where we don't have 3 tigers confiscated from suburban Texas neighborhoods in the span of 3 months.
You know? Exactly.
Like, I do believe we can get to that point. I am overly optimistic, but I do think that once we can curtail the public contact, whether it's with the baby monkeys or whether it's with big cats are so much, when they get big, are a lot harder to hide, I guess, than a monkey. So, and a lot harder to take care of in a lot of cases. I think we've seen so much progress. I mean, we last met, Alex, a year ago talking about this issue. And since then, every single roadside zoo or roadside zoo owner depicted in Tiger King is either in prison, indicted for wildlife trafficking or animal cruelty, under investigation, subjected to hundreds of thousands of dollars of penalties that have put them out of business. Just this week, Jeff Lowe had 68 big cats confiscated by the feds. That's 100% of the rest of his inventory of big cats. So
that's amazing.
All of them but one, Mario, down in Florida. They're all, like, I mean, the dominoes are falling. So
good. I'm happy to finally see that they're actually doing something. The thing is that they need to implement these laws so that it can make it, you know, punish these people and to a higher degree,
for sure,
you know. And that's the problem why the whole animal trade is such one of the fourth largest illicit profit in the world, is because you barely get a slap in the hand when you get caught, as opposed to when you know, you get caught with a kilo of cocaine, you're gonna go to prison probably close to the rest of your life. 20 plus 30 40 years. But why not
sea turtle eggs or something? It's like, hey, here's a fine.
Right.
Yeah, endangered sea turtle. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or bringing in exotic birds, you know, and tucked into your sweater in an airport. And like, how is that not punishable?
Yeah. Well, and it's rarely, if I've noticed, you know, I mean, just anecdotally, it's really hard for me to think of a wildlife trafficking or wildlife crimes case that doesn't also involve some other type of criminal activity. I mean, just this last week, the special investigator with Fish and Wildlife Service who had investigated Joe Exotic's case was involved in an investigation of a guy who had illegal bald eagle parts and was also convicted. So he was convicted of wildlife crimes and he's waiting for sentencing on that, but also of sex trafficking and like sex crimes with minors. And so it just like, I you know, what I tell people all the time is like, it's really hard for me to think of somebody who's involved in wildlife trafficking, who's not also involved in something other horrible, frequent exploitation involving people. So
crime begets crime.
Right.
Regardless, you know, whether it's so, animals or drugs or weapons, it's all part of the same business.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so it's just, we need to, I think that if people aren't as, even if there are people who aren't as concerned about the animal crimes, need to understand that when you're addressing animal crimes, you're actually helping prevent a lot of other bad stuff too.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah, because smugglers who are smuggling in the animals, you know, they have ways and means to smuggle, you know, other things in. And so it's not just the parrot or the sea turtle or
right.
or anything like that. It's the, or, you know, it's the drugs as well. It's the, the weapons, you know, all those things that you know, make the world a little less safe. But going back on your point, Carney, is that the pessimist in me, it agrees with your husband. It tells me that this is a, you know, there will never be 100%. You know, something tells me like, you know, there's always going to be someone, but the optimist in me, it tells me, well, no, you know what, we're making strides. Things can get better. And in this situation, with the Safety Act, you know, sometimes it needs to be pushed along a little bit differently than education. I know we teach young children, and education is key in every respect. But you know, there's those people that are already in, you know, have their thoughts engraved and say, well, animals are for my pleasure. What I do what I want with them when I want. And you know, those are the people that need these laws to be enforced against. You know, the kids are the ones, you know, they're the curious ones. They're the ones that want a pet, of course. They don't realize what it means. But the adults are the ones that should be a little bit more educated and realize, no, a baby tiger is not the right pet. You know, that's not the right way to go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's twofold. Good.
And yeah, bad. No, it's true. I you know, I don't think that it'll be like you said, 100% you know, that's what we're working towards. And we'll probably always be working towards that 100%. But the harder we make it for people to get these animals and to hide them and to, you know, keep them, then hopefully it will price most people out of even being able to acquire them. Because when it's harder to get them, it's going to be a lot more expensive. You're not going to be able to get a tiger for free anymore.
Right.
Like you can now.
Yeah.
So,
you know, Carney, I wanted to ask you a question. What do you, I'm sure you've heard of these, there's a lab or science group of scientists that are creating, rhino, or I guess it's essentially a synthesized rhino horn. It's not a real rhino horn, but they're trying to flood the market with it to try to basically bring the price down of rhino horns, like to basically zero. So that way it's, you know, not lucrative anymore. Have you heard of
that? Yeah. I have heard a little bit of something about that. And I have mixed feelings because I think when you create it, it's kind of like faux fur, right? Like you're still promoting the aesthetic. And so it's still on some level, I mean, obviously it's better to have some, you know, something that does not involve animal cruelty or poaching of a protected species. slaughtering protected species, but or any species. But I also think I don't know that it'll have the intended consequence of reducing demand so much. You know, we're seeing that the tiger bone trade is being supplemented by lion bones, and that lion bones are easily passed off as tiger parts. Right. And so that's kind of, those parts are flooding the market. To me, it's a bit of a gray area that I'm not thoroughly convinced that it's the right solution. I feel like that we need to really ramp up the penalties for people who are caught with or participants in any type of, whether it's poaching or whether it's like illegal trade or possession of any types of parts. Right.
It kind of reminds me a little bit about, I think there's a farmer out in Africa who's farming the rhino horn and selling it legally so that the rhinos are not being killed.
Right.
But then it goes to what you say, it's still kind of promoting that.
And then how do you know that your rhino horn's been ethically sourced? You know what I mean? Like, won't that create a market for people to pass off poached rhino horn, whatever?
I think the person's going to buy a rhino doesn't probably even really give a crap to begin with.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's probably one of the questions they're probably going to be even asking, is this rhino poached ethically?
Yeah.
If you're buying
a rhino, I think we have to stop feeling entitled. This entitlement mentality to having close contact, to feeling like these animals are just here to fulfill whatever whim we have, whatever purpose we see that we want them to fill for us. Like, I don't, whenever I get asked the question, like, well, how else are, you know, my kids going to ever be able to get up close to a tiger? Like, my response is, I don't feel like my kids have, are entitled to ever experience that. Like, some things we're not, just because some, you know, an animal exists doesn't mean we're entitled to everything, to just go into nature and do whatever we want, whenever we want, in whatever proximity, with these animals. Like, I just don't see that. I don't buy into that entitlement mentality.
Right. No, I agree.
It's a very egotistical,
frame of mind.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And then it's one thing that Sam and I haven't even discussed. It's like, well, okay, people, you know, say that, well, how am I going to educate my kids if I can't go and see them? Like, well, there's so many different ways, and there's a lot of different ways that even zoos can switch over to, by doing, you know, so much technology that we have nowadays, by, you know, these kids can walk into a room, you know, 360 virtual reality, and then let's put them in a jungle. Let's put them in a safari. Yeah. Let's put all those smells inside that room. How much more education they're going to get there? I mean, I feel like they'll be educated a lot more and actually seeing what the animals are actually doing in the wild, as opposed to seeing that elephant just turn into circles and bobbing his head up and down because it's depressed and it's been sitting, you know, it's been living there and for the last 18, 20 years.
Yeah. Okay. I agree. Yeah. There's nothing.
Keep that thought in mind, because that's what we're going to do. We're going to create a virtual reality education center where you come in, you're going to live an experience like that. So copyright, trademark.
I want in on this, because no joke. Yesterday I was on my run, and I literally, the whole time I was running, I was thinking about the role of technology in animal education going forward, because, you know, we're in this rapidly evolving time of, you know, cryptocurrency and AI and VR, and the world is moving so fast. Like, I don't know, is it even going to be 10 years before having a steering wheel in our car is irrelevant? So like, I totally believe, like, let's, you know, the future of a traditional zoo, I think, is going to fall by the wayside.
Virtual zoos.
And you can have it anywhere. Imagine you can have a virtual zoo in downtown LA. You know, where you walk in, it's almost like a museum, but it's, I mean, you walk in and you're in the jungle, you're out in South America, you're in India, you're in Africa.
You can smell it.
Imagine having all these amazing sound engineers bringing all that sound to you, all these amazing cinematographers going around the world, documenting all these backgrounds, documenting all the animals like Planet Earth and these BBC document, brilliant people. Putting that into a virtual zoo, I would be there all the time. And then change it up. You can change it up. You don't have to trade animals. Today's special is orangutans in Borneo. Tomorrow we're doing elephants in the safari. I mean,
oh my gosh,
it never ends. It's never never ends.
Let's get started.
Okay, you know what we need to do? We need to create NFTs.
Yes.
That come with a virtual experience.
Absolutely. That's like, what it is.
Here's your tiger NFT. And it comes with, you know, maybe one of your rescue missions that's documented. And then, you know,
perfect.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know, guys. I think we're onto something here.
I agree. I mean,
Sam we might not want to share this part of the discussion.
Probably not. We can cut this. But Sam and I have been talking about this for years. I mean, we've been discussing something like this. I mean, it just takes a little bit of capital, but it's nothing that far out.
Imagine that. This is something that museums can incorporate as well. You don't need much space. You don't need, you know, the world of zoos need, you know, they need massive spaces, even though the animals only get tiny spaces, but yet the humans get these long corridors to walk through all, you know, big tramways and all of this stuff, huge areas where you can binge on, you know, soda and popcorn, but tiny little spaces for the attractions, right? The animals there. So we don't, that's it. That's going back to that thought of, well, what I want to experience the real thing. You're not experiencing the real thing. No. You're experiencing it's like saying, let me go see what a human does. And you go to their office building and while they're clicking away in their office, like, is that what a human is?
Or a prison.
What a human does. Or a prison. Right. There you go. Thank you. You know, well, working in an office is sometimes just, I mean,
amen.
But, you know, it's a similar thought. You're not getting a reality. You're just getting some, you know, fake misinterpretation with a little placard that says, hey, look, we're educating you.
I tell people all the time, like, there's nothing educational about you know, taking your kids to see animals in environments that don't even provide them with the ability to engage in their most basic normal behaviors. Like, what's educational about that? You referenced, Alex, the elephants, you know, like, just kind of walking around in circles, or whether it's, you know, head swaying, and what we see is like all these facilities, including, you know, what zoos saying, oh, they're dancing, like, it's, you know, they're dancing to music, like, no, that's like, that's, these behaviors are born from years of suffering psychologically in these cramped spaces.
Perfect examples are Billy the elephant. I think it's Billy the elephant here in the LA zoo that's been they've been trying to put him in a sanctuary, I think up in Paws in Northern California, which said they've taken him. I've even been out to court in some of the sessions of them trying to release him. I mean, I think it's been a fighting battle for years, but and I think the reason why they're not doing it is because they're selling his sperm to other zoos.
It's problematic. The elephant situation is super problematic because, and this is why we've seen zoos buy elephants from, we had the whole import of elephants by three different accredited zoos from Africa. And because the elephants are dying in captivity faster than they can, than they're being born, because elephants don't naturally, they're under so much stress. It's very difficult for them to breed in captivity. It's usually unsuccessful. So there's this, you know, a lot of artificial insemination. Now we're seeing zoos purchasing animals from the wild to maintain that genetic diversity and to also supplement their dying population.
Yeah.
And we're just warehousing them. We're not repopulating the wild. We're just warehousing them for human entertainment.
That's exactly it. And then, you know, people say, well, you know, it's conservation. They're breeding them so that we can have them here and they won't go extinct. But that doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help the elephant. How about we breed them and we try to put them out in the wild? How about we start doing those programs?
How about we focus it out there? Yeah, you know, giving the backing it needs is to continue purchasing land or fighting to make more reservations in the areas that need it. You know, start blocking.
That's what our virtual zoo can support.
Yeah, absolutely.
Real conservation.
Right. Real conservation. Real conservation. Yeah, absolutely.
You know. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. There's the sky's the limit nowadays with technology, and that's the beauty of it. And it's not fair. You know, it's not fair that we have so much at our hands and we still go back to these archaic
place. Well, and this is why I'm so excited to see so many creative minds and talented filmmakers like yourselves involved in the animal protection world now, because I think that the movement is so entrenched in business as usual mentality. Animal protection movement is not a like entrepreneurial innovative space. And we really are desperate for more creative minds, people who are on the forefront of emerging technologies, because that's where we're going to solve these problems. We're not going to rescue our way out of this problem. We're not going to I don't even think we're going to legislate our way out of this problem. We're going to need to actually evolve and innovate out of this problem.
Right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's going to have to take us creatives, us that are in the forefront, to change people's minds, because I don't think politicians are going to do anything for us. I mean, we just spoke last week about how I think Idaho just put out, I think they made it legal now to kill 90% of the wolf population. I mean, this is coming straight from the government. I'm like, how is this being possible? How is this possible? How is this still happening?
Yeah.
90% of the wolves, I believe there's 1500 wolves, I think, in Idaho right now. 90%. I mean, do the math, people. Think about that. Yeah. How many wolves are going to be left in Idaho, in the whole state? It boggles my mind. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. And like, I don't understand why. And I remember texting you and asking, like, well, what can we do? Is there somebody?
I know, buy all the hunting licenses. I don't know.
I actually went out and calculated it. Since I'm not an Idaho, resident, it costs a lot more. I mean, I had to come up with thousands of dollars, but.
Yeah.
Who knows? The thing is that they were, I think they put them out in this to sell, pre-sale in December of the previous year. Yeah. I think they go like that. They go fast.
Yeah.
You know, and I was even looking at what it costs to kill some of these, to hunt these, like the bears. It's like, you're talking about a few hundred bucks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
really,
it's gross.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's unfortunately. Yeah.
But I mean, there's definitely been some good developments in the last year. So
yes.
I
think people are heading in the right direction.
I
think we've reached this really, really steep, point. And I think we're starting to take a look at ourselves and realize that we're not the impermanence of everything, and how little we have, and how much we have to hold on to it,
right?
As much as we can before it's gone.
So what's next for you guys? Like, where are you right now with Furthest from the Wild, and where can people kind of see what you're up to and stay up to date on any updates and see some of your awesome content?
Right now you can visit the website. You can get all our information, subscribe to our newsletter, and we'll be updating you. We're doing a collection of rescues right now. It hasn't been released out to the public yet, but our goal is we're trying to do about 5 to 6 episodes. We got 4 already so far, and then our goal is to find a home for them, somebody that will actually want to continue filming more of these rescues for us.
The idea,
exactly, for sure. and get it out in the to air so that people can see it. So that's kind of what we're working on right now. We're in negotiations, I guess you would say.
Yeah. Cool. So I know that when we talked last year and I asked you about, you know, if you had like one particular rescue that's like been like sort of stuck in your mind, and you told me about the monkey case.
Yeah.
Is there anything that's happened in the last year that's been really impactful for both of you? Like,
Let's see, in the last year,
there's the monkey case still.
Yeah, I think
sticking with you.
It's definitely a good one. I think, well, we just, like I mentioned earlier, we did the New Guinea singing dogs. So that was a whole new experience, because I would have never had thought that I would go out and film a rescue for New Guinea singing dogs. I mean, I would expect to something like a primate or a big cat, you know, your usual.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. And I just started learning. Sam and I started reading more up on it. Sam started talking to me about, hey, did you know that these were thought to be extinct until, you know, the early 2000s. Yeah.
So is that a Lazarus? Do they call that a Lazarus species? A species that's like presumed extinct, and then they like discover? I think there's a name for that.
I don't know the name, but that sounds right. They were essentially, you know, missing, and then all of a sudden they're like, wait a minute, that still exists. Holy moly.
Yeah.
You know,
it's been years. So we're contacting a specialist, as I've been doing some studies on them. So I'm interested to hear more about that species, just because it's not a common species that people, you know, hear about every day. So I think that's going to be very unique to the show.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. And of course,
how about you, Sam? What?
They're not, you know, dogs that you want to have at home, you know, as cute and pretty, you know, as those animals are. You know, they're not pets, and they're not meant to be pets. They are they are wild animals that deserve to be where they are, in their homes, not the ones that were rescued. Of course, they deserve to be in the wild. I agree. I mean, I you know, that honestly, 2020 was 2020.
Right.
Just leave it like that. So essentially our production was pretty mellow all of 2020, but you know, it was mostly background stuff, you know, getting the contracts and the paperwork and, you know, getting all that stuff done. But yeah, it was a nice change of pace to finally go out and, you know, film something and you know, go through the process. It's never linear. There's never anything that just goes so smoothly that you're just like, oh, that was how are we gonna make this into a story? No, it always just ends up being a story, because it's life happens throughout in the process. And so luckily for us, that's what we're doing. We're just documenting it. We're just putting a camera up to it and saying, well, you know, this is what happened throughout that time. And so this is cute as these dogs are, they're not ferocious and scary and can't bite your head off or anything like that. Maybe they can nip you a little bit and it might hurt for a few minutes, but it, you know, it's not about that. You know, not the series has never been about how scary or how much drama we can pack into one episode. Absolutely not. Even as much as, you know, some TV series try to push that, ours is not. We see, you know, you see so much reality TV. Ours is not reality TV, it's just reality.
Yeah.
You know, we're not making a, you know, hopefully we'll air it and get it all, you know, going through that, but we're not producing it. It's just happening, and we're there we're happy and lucky to be, you know, having the cameras and showing the world these stories, these moments that would otherwise go unnoticed, you know.
Yeah. No, thank goodness you are. I'm headed to Winnemucca, Nevada, the week after next. There's a roadside zoo from Oregon that essentially got kicked out of Oregon that's trying to set up shop in Nevada. So I got a phone call from our friends at the GFAS accredited sanctuary in Nevada. And I'm gonna go try to help them out with that situation and giving some testimony to the county about why they should not issue a conditional use permit for this particular roadside zoo. So,
good.
And I know that Nevada is like finally, like after all these years of being one of the last four states standing with no exotic animal regulations, oversight, or limitations on the state level. They're finally toying with it. And I think that this facility wants to kind of sneak in and get in time to be grandfathered in if the new law passes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a facility that's done business with Joe Exotic. And they've got over a dozen big cats and a number of primates and other species. And so that's my sort of next adventure.
Good. Well, if you need Furthest from the Wild there, we can help you out.
You guys are welcome to come up if you want to, if that would be helpful to your, helpful to your narrative of, you know, like just getting some of the, like, kind of what's happening and how these places come to be. And
absolutely. So, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll give you the details.
We talked about, I think years ago, I think wasn't one of the musicians trying to put back his show down in Nevada?
So Dirk Arthur, the magician, for a period of time, and he had, in the movie The Conservation Game, there's a discussion about snow leopards that, you know, protected snow leopards and where they end up, and a magician receiving a snow leopard from a breeding facility in Kansas. And that was Dirk Arthur. To my knowledge, he's not gained a foothold again. I think that a lot of his animals have been sent elsewhere at this point. But I'm not entirely sure where they ended up.
Okay.
Or if he's kept some, but I don't believe that he's, I don't believe that he has had any more. I mean, certainly not in the last year.
Right.
To my knowledge, it's not.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. So,
I mean, every little piece, every little, you know, moment like these are little victories that we have to celebrate. You know.
Yeah. Did I tell you, Alex, that when I went to go, like, I went to a Dirk Arthur show to see, you know, how the big cats were used.
Yeah.
And he pulled me up on stage.
No way.
For one of his, he selected me from the audience for one of his. It was so weird and it was so bizarre because I'd actually just sent a letter to his management company about the, you know, USDA violations and all that stuff, illegal declawing and all these things. Yeah, so it was very bizarre to go up, and it wasn't a trick using a cat. Thankfully, it was just like a card trick. But I was like, "Oh my god, like, what, this is like,
right?
What are the chances?" That being said, the chances were actually pretty good because at this point, his audience had dwindled to, like, I think I counted like 30 people at this particular show. So I mean, he was just kind of circling the drain at that point, I think.
I got free tickets when you roll spin that wheel outside, or the Tropicana or whatever it was at the time
he had.
And I did get free tickets to go see him. This was almost 20 years ago. And I will say, even then, before Furthest from the Wild, before even really diving into this world that we're more in now, having those cats did not add any meaningful value to the experience. I love magic.
Me too.
But that,
yeah, David Blaine street magic, definitely.
Excellent.
But no,
excellent.
Yeah.
Having big cats or animals in your show does not increase any value, in my opinion. If you can produce a show that makes you have a feeling experience, Penn and Teller, I don't think uses any animals from what I have.
They are, however, huge supporters of, like, circuses, and they're very friendly to exotic animal ownership. So
now I know. But I will say, in the my experience, I did go see them. They did have an animal on stage. And at least in my opinion, it, like I said, it didn't add any meaningful value to the experience as a person being there and seeing any animal running through the stage or being on the stage. You're so far away, it doesn't really matter anyways. It can be a fake animal, it can be a puppet. make something disappear, that's cool enough for me. You don't need to make an actual tiger disappear. No.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, when I was a teenager, I went to see Siegfried and Roy with my dad, and this was long before I was aware of a lot of animal protection issues, but I was not aware of the ethical problems with breeding white tigers. I wasn't aware of the exotic animal crisis in the United States. I wasn't aware, and this was like the late 90s. So I had no idea. Until I actually started working in the field, and I was like, oh my gosh, those guys were squarely in the middle of promoting a lot of the kind of Frankencat species that the roadside zoos like Doc Antle and Jeff Lowe and Joe Exotic and all these guys like breed to create on purpose to draw crowds.
Think they kind of made the whole white tiger kind of famous, in my opinion.
There's just sort of like a fraud on the public, like the royal white Bengal tiger, like it's just such a fiction. And
the fake narrative that they pushed, that it's rare. You need to come to see it there, and you'll think you're so
No, it's not supposed to exist.
No, please. It's a joke. We all remember the attack of Siegfried and Roy. And the narrative that was put in, in the news, said that it was a protection thing, right?
Right. Like, oh yeah.
It was supposed to be the tiger was heard a bang or it did something, and then it picked them, grabbed them and said, "Oh, I'm gonna protect you and save you." We've spoken to some, tiger experts that say that's an absolute complete bogus.
There was an expose recently, within the past couple of years, that one of the big cat handlers who worked for them came forward and said they never even built relationships with those cats. So that cat didn't have a special relationship where he was being protective. Like, they were completely hands off. Those cats were just for show. They weren't interested, at least according to this particular individual and what he reported witnessing and the dynamics that he alleged. So he kind of like blew the lid off of all the whitewashing that was done to make it seem like there was some sort of sweet story happening at the root of that whole tragic, awful situation. Tragic for the cat too, obviously.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
So
when we heard that, we're like, does everybody know about this? Like, why, one of the first instances where you're just like, wait a minute, they control the narrative completely. That was not what happened. Like, how did they do that? I thought the news was supposed to tell you what happened, not what, got from the producers or the managers of the show, it wasn't very long after that, the big cat world people, the ones that really know the animals, they were just like, no way, that wasn't a rescue, that wasn't him protecting, that was no way, that's not even close. That's what happened.
Well, guys, this has been super fun.
Yeah, it has.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's we need good to do see you both. Often. Yeah, for sure. I love that. That'd be tomorrow. Awesome.
Yeah.
but no joke, I will send you the information for my little venture up to I'm flying into Reno. And then I think Winnemucca is like a 2-hour drive or something like that. So
send me the info. Let's see if we have time see if we can make it out there.
Okay.
And document that whole process. I think that would be interesting for people to see. Okay.
Safe Haven, the sanctuary, is like halfway in between. So like, I'm probably gonna, go there and visit, because that's one of the sanctuaries I've never visited before. So
Safe Haven, yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So, yeah, awesome. That sounds good.
Awesome. All right. Okay, well, take care. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Have a good one. Say hi to your family for me.
Will do. Likewise. Okay. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Well, thanks for joining us on Tiger Talk today for this fun conversation with Alex and Sam. Always fun to catch up with them and hear what exciting projects they're up to. And, you know, we talked about the Big Cat Public Safety Act and the importance of getting it passed. It really is the key to ending America's tiger crisis. So if you haven't yet contacted your federal legislators and urged them to co-sponsor the Big Cat Public Safety Act, then please take 30 seconds and do that. It's been reintroduced in both houses of Congress, and it is critical that we get this across the finish line. I have a lot of hope that we can do it this year, but it's important that we all take a minute to contact our legislators and make sure that our voices are heard. So until next time, be safe, be healthy, and I look forward to having you join me again on the next episode of Tiger Talk.